So the title of tonight's talk is Don't Be a Buddhist. So is that cheap sensationalism? You bet it is. So let me start with a story. A couple of years ago, I was at a party in Marin County, and lovely place, beautiful weather, and you know, a lot of outdoor areas and a lot of rooms inside. So people were wandering around, conversations forming and dissolving here and there. So I was walking through one of the rooms, and there was a small group of people. There was a guy there who had what looked like a child's toy. It was, you know, a plastic thing that had a blue light, bright blue light on it. So I walked up and was sort of looking at it, and other people were discussing it, and I said, oh, what's that? And the two other people who were there were sort of walked away. I have a feeling in retrospect they were glad to sort of be able to get away from this. But anyway, so I asked, what's that? And the guy with the blue light device said, it's a blue laser. So, a little bit of an alarm bell went off, because I know that there's no such thing as a blue laser. There are yellow lasers and red lasers and green lasers, but they've been unable to make a blue laser. And if you could, you would be a candidate for the Nobel Prize in Physics, because they'd love to have a blue laser, because they predict that such a thing would have all kinds of properties that the other lasers don't. So it would be very helpful for all kinds of subatomic and molecular level research. So, blue laser, unlikely. But, you know, I play along. I'm going to be well behaved with this guy. So I say, it's a blue laser. What does it do? And so he said, it puts you in touch with the quantum field. So, right, exactly. So I thought that was really good, because, you know, quantum field, I'm not sure if that has any meaning in this context at all. You know, if you Google quantum field, you're probably going to find weeping physicists. So I play along. I go, okay, quantum field, wow, what's that? So he says, it's like what the Buddha taught 5,000 years ago, that we are all one. So then I stop and say, well, the Buddha actually taught 2,500 years ago, and he didn't say anything remotely like that. Now, somebody else came along and sort of interrupted things, so the conversation dropped. But it's one of those things that stayed with me, because, I mean, yeah, it's funny, but I was being kind of a jerk. You know, I was kind of being a good Buddhist, sort of a Buddhist enforcer. Yeah, you're wrong about the Buddha. It wasn't 5,000 years ago, and he didn't say we are all one. So hence the title, Don't Be a Buddhist, because here I was being a good Buddhist, and I was being a jerk. So the point of the talk is, I'm going to touch on a couple of different topics, but is being a Buddhist, being a good Buddhist, does that get in the way of our practice? And what does that mean? So just going back to the blue laser guy, you know, obviously he doesn't know a lot about who the Buddha was or what he taught, but most people don't. But the Buddha has sort of taken on iconic status in our culture, and in most cultures in the world, I guess. We think of the Buddha as, or many people think of the Buddha as sort of a jolly fat man, like a clean-shaven Santa Claus. You see a lot of these sort of fat, laughing Buddhas. We've got a couple of them in our house. It's very typical mem for thinking of the Buddha. And also, if you go around to people's gardens, you will find lots of not garden gnomes, you'll find lots of Buddhas. The Buddha is sort of like the garden gnome of our decade. And it's sort of a vague symbol of serenity, sort of a mellowness, just like, I want to be like the Buddha, man, don't harsh my mellow. But the Buddha was a real person. He did teach. He said real things. He lived 2,500 years ago, and he did not call himself a Buddhist. And his followers didn't call themselves Buddhists. They didn't call him the Buddha. They called him the Blessed One. And sort of a side note here, he called himself the Tathagata, which is, many people think, is some kind of a pun, because it can be broken up into two different ways in Pali. And the Buddha did not speak Pali. Probably he spoke Magadha. But they're both vernaculars of Sanskrit. So the translation is probably very straightforward. But it could be Tata Gata or Tat Agata. And one of those phrases means the one who has arrived, and the other one, or the one who has come. And the other phrase means the one who is gone, as in gone beyond. And the theory, one popular theory, and I kind of like this, is that this was a deliberate pun, that the Buddha was calling himself both the one who has come, you know, to bring this practice, to bring this life, and he's the one who has gone beyond this world. So there are a lot of forms of Buddhism today in the world, and they're most of them are recognizable. If you look at them, there is a core that we all share, even though there may be all kinds of trappings and surface visuals that look quite different. The Buddhist teachings appealed to people in many different cultures. And a number of reasons for that. I think one of the reasons it's popular in the West and may have been popular with other cultures is a very empirical nature. It's much more focused on try this for yourself. Don't take my word for it. See if this works for you. And I think there's an inherent appeal in that. I think also that it was not competitive with belief-based systems. Since the Buddha was really not focused on ontological statements, he was focused on epistemology. And I love using those words. It always makes me feel like I have a big, powerful brain. When you say an ontological statement is a statement about reality. It's an assertion about reality, like the universe was created in 7 days by a powerful deity. That's an ontological statement. The universe started with the Big Bang. That's also an ontological statement. So the statement might be true, might not be true, it might not be even provable one way or the other. But it's a statement about reality, fundaments of reality. Epistemological statements are about what we know, what we can know, the nature of awareness, the nature of knowledge itself. And the Buddha was very much focused on what can we know, how can we know it, what is our experience, what is our relationship to suffering, what is our relationship to our awareness, not what is true about our awareness. Of course, today we have all of these different movements in Buddhism, long traditions that have diverged very widely. And just in the last century, they started encountering each other again with some very interesting results, sometimes comical. There is a story that many of you have already heard about some conference that took place, I think, in Colorado about 30 years ago or more, sometime in the 70s, I believe. And so there were Buddhists from all over the world there. And it's reported that there was a conversation with the help of translators between a Tibetan Buddhist monk and a Korean Zen master. And the Korean Zen master picked up an orange from the table and held it up and said, "What is this?" And this is sort of like a koan statement. You're not supposed to, shrug your shoulders and wonder what he's talking about. It's supposed to sort of shake you out of your normal way of perceiving things. This is a big theme in Zen Buddhism and can be very powerful. But anyway, he says, "What is this?" And so the Tibetan turns to his translator and says, "What, don't they have oranges in Korea?" But one of the great things about all this coming together of these different traditions is that there's a lot of wisdom in all of them. Maybe not all. Well, okay, in most of them, there's a lot of wisdom. And we've been able to borrow a lot from other practices. Some of the methods and attitudes in Dzogchen have been very helpful to people in the West. I think the Zen idea of don't know mine, we use a lot of these concepts in our Vipassana world. And being a good Buddhist is one of those things that can get in the way of absorbing some of this wisdom from other lineages. We can get so wrapped up in our particular brand of Buddhism. And you know, every brand of Buddhism has a tendency to do this. We, of course, have the oldest and largest collection of the actual, of sort of the closest that we know of to the Buddha's actual teachings in the Pali Canon. And we've been very conservative about staying very close to it. So, you know, we feel pretty special about that. And there's some great stuff about that, and I think some of the other lineages have benefited from that. But a lot of really brilliant stuff has come out of Vajrayana and many of the Mahayana branches, and we should be open to that. So there's a big issue that I've thought about a lot lately about what I think of as hardcore Buddhism. Because the Buddha really taught a lot about disenchantment with the world, about leaving the wheel of death and rebirth. And there's a lot to that. And we get so caught up in thinking that the secret to happiness is in our circumstances. And to some extent, you know, if we're not being chased by Cossacks or if we're not suffering from a terrible disease, we're more likely to be happy. So this is not entirely a false assertion. But you look at how many people lead what is materially a pretty good-looking life and yet they spend a lot of time moping. You realize that there really is a sense that people rely way too much, or they think that, you know, getting a better job or getting a better boyfriend or getting a better car is going to make everything fine. And we know from experience that it won't. Or, you know, for years it was, everyone thought that the solution to their problems, the key to happiness would be to have $1 million. And there was only a small group of people who knew that having $1 million was not the secret to happiness. We call them millionaires. The millionaires all knew that what it took to make them happy was $1 billion. And so we know about all those happy billionaires out there. So there's this tension between having a better life now and being completely disenchanted with the world. And the Buddha taught some fairly disturbing things. He said that, for instance, for monks anyway, and I'll bring this up, the Buddha did say different things to lay people and to the monastics. But if you were a monk, you were supposed to regard food as a necessary evil. And in fact, eating was supposed to be like eating your own baby. Not a nice picture. In fact, the Buddha once went to a group of monks that were staying at a place that was fairly far from where the Buddha was staying at that time. So he went to this remote group and he gave a long talk on the repulsiveness of the human body and how disgusting it was. And then he left, went back to his regular place. And then word came to him a little while later that a bunch of those monks had committed suicide. So, I mean, this wasn't what the Buddha had in mind, and he went back and he told them so. But you can see that there's this idea that that disenchantment can be taken a little bit too far. Or maybe not. I mean, if you really want to follow a monastic life, then maybe this is the right attitude to take. But the Buddha did say delight not. For instance, monks are not supposed to listen to music or have idle entertainments. But I kind of like delight. I think a lot of people like delight. And one of the things about delight that makes our practice a little tricky, kind of a tightrope act, is that mindfulness can enrich our lives and our ability to delight. And if you're mindful about the food you're eating, if it's a good meal, you enjoy it more. I noticed today when we went walking in Briones Park in the East Bay. And so I spent part of the time, you know, thinking about stuff like, what am I going to say tonight? And then at times I would say, oh, wait a minute, I'm walking in a park. This is supposed to be nice. And I'd stop and I'd look around and you know, just be mindful of where I was. And it was great. And, you know, I really enjoyed it. It was really beautiful. The colors were bright. And then after a while, my mind was going to start in on things again. But the point is that when we're mindful of our lives, there's a great deal more capacity for enjoyment and for delight. So that's kind of tricky, this balance between having a better life and becoming completely enlightened and leaving the wheel entirely. Now, this thing about mindfulness brings up, there, as many of you know, there's a debate about mindfulness-based stress reduction. Lisa Dale Miller spoke, I think, last year or the year before about this. And last year, and she, you know, strongly opinionated, and I respect that. I'm not very opinionated on this. I'm downright wishy-washy. I think one of the issues is that mindfulness-based stress reduction can really improve people's life and lessen the suffering in their life. On the other hand, there's not much emphasis on ethics. So there's this question, can you have ethics without a cosmic carrot and stick system? Because there are a lot of people out there, right-wing Christians saying that atheists must be bad people because, of course, they're not worried about heaven and hell. I like to think that ethics is a fairly natural thing, that if you were meditating, which I hope you all are, you've probably noticed by now that it's really hard to meditate after a day of raping and pillaging. Or so I'm told. Are people innately ethical? I like to think that they are, but I am an optimist, and I don't have a good intellectual argument for this, but I just have this sense that they are. I will bring up, just because I like any excuse to bring it up, there's a sutta, or sutra is the Sanskrit word, a talk that the Buddha gave. Actually, it was somebody else who gave the talk, but the Buddha approved it. And it's called the Safe Bet Sutta. And it's actually very slow reading, and you have to practically use Boolean algebra to figure out what they're getting at. But what it is that somebody's come to the Buddha's inner circle, and he's saying, I'm not sure about this rebirth business, but what I figure is that if there is rebirth and I'm a bad person, I'm going to be reborn as something bad, like a squirrel or a cockroach, and I'll be unhappy. If there is rebirth and I'm good, then I'll be reborn in a better place. I'll be reborn in a better realm. So it pays off. If there is rebirth, it pays off to be good. If there is no rebirth, and this lifetime is the only one there is, if I'm a bad person, then I'll be less happy. And if I'm a good person, I'll be happy. And so somebody said, so what do you think? Tathagata and the Buddha said, yeah, I'm the Buddha and I approve this message. And what I like about that, by the way, is that it's called Safe Bet Sutta. It uses the wagering, just the title of it, and I don't know when the title was added to it, but it uses the wagering analogy. And so it's just like Pascal's wager, which also uses the betting analogy. Pascal's wager is in the West, and it's the same thing except that it substitutes rebirth, heaven and hell for rebirth. So if you're bad and there is a hell, you'll go to hell. If you're good and there's a hell, you'll go to heaven. If you're bad you'll be unhappy. If you're good, you'll be happy. And I think a lot of people discover this for themselves, that one of the worst things, one of the worst experiences we tend to have in this life is remorse for pain that we've caused. It's so hard to forgive oneself for the harm that one has done. So I think there's a continuum in our practice between the total disenchantment with the world and with just improving our ability to indulge in everything in the world, which mindfulness could help us with if we wanted to do that. Mindfulness could help us enjoy all those good things in the world more effectively. With or with, you know, this is sort of aside from the ethics argument. So a question is, where is your practice on this continuum? You're unlikely to be at either one of these extremes, or you wouldn't be here. And in looking at where you are in your practice, is being a good Buddhist in the way of helping you determine where you are in that continuum? Here's another way of looking, another way of looking at the good Buddhism issue, and that is lay versus monastic practice, which is a little bit what we're already touching on, this idea of pursuing complete disenchantment so that we can go beyond the world entirely. And by the way, I respect people who make that choice. I don't make that choice for myself, but love monastics. And then on the other hand, complete indulgence. There's also the Buddha taught lay people and monastics differently. So he wasn't anti-happiness. I'm giving a little bit of a straw man argument here. When he talked to lay people, he talked about happiness. And his advice to lay people was pretty much basic Dear Abby type advice. Have a good family, have good work, be ethical in your behavior, have good digestion, things like that. But in terms of practice, in terms of a transformative practice, to lay people he taught generosity and ethics. And it was to the monastics he taught meditation. And also indirectly service, because monastics, of course, relied on the lay community, and the lay community came to rely on the monastics. There was a close relationship there. But enlightenment mostly was not for lay people. There are a few stories in the suttas about lay people who hear the Buddha speak and become instantly enlightened, but generally what they do is they immediately take the robes and join the monastic order. The one exception is the story of Bahia, who gets the express version of enlightenment. I'm not going to go into what it is. It is pretty good, but everyone here has probably heard it a bunch of times. But Bahia becomes enlightened, and then within 24 hours, he's gored by a bull and dies. So I guess enlightenment either leads you to the robes or it's lethal, is the message. So the idea of lay meditation practice is relatively recent. Lay people didn't meditate in the Buddhist time. And throughout history, to the best of my knowledge anyway, lay people did not meditate. I have a feeling that there were lay meditation movements here and there that we just don't know about. But really, lay practice is relatively recent. And my understanding is that Mahasi Sayadaw in Burma was the one who really started doing 10-day retreats for lay people in a monastic environment. And it was part of a movement towards lay meditation practice on a wide scale in Burma in the middle of the 20th century. So in a way, we're beneficiaries of something that is not traditional Buddhist practice at all. The idea that lay people could actually meditate seriously and benefit from it is a pretty radical concept when you look at the progress over 2,500 years of how Buddhism has evolved. So is it truly Buddhist? You could argue that if we were really serious Buddhists, we would either go back to being on good behavior or we'd take the robes. And instead we have found something in between. Another aspect of this is that there are a lot of valuable practices that the Buddha never talked about and don't show up in classical Buddhism. And one of them is body scanning. And yet Goenka has taught this, and people find it very powerful. It's also used a lot in mindfulness-based stress reduction. The idea of just scanning the body for the sensations as a way of getting out of the coconut and into the felt sense, into embodied awareness. Very powerful practice. The Buddha doesn't talk about it at all. I was on retreat, a number of us were on retreat recently with Venerable Analio, who is pretty hardcore Buddhist. He's hardcore enough that he has taken the Satipatthana Sutta and he's thrown out the parts that are not also in the Chinese translations that have shown up. So he's gone back to what he thinks is the Satipatthana Sutta as it was practiced and taught in the very earliest days of Buddhism, before there was Theravada versus Sarvastivada or any of the other groups that came and went. So, and he does, some teachers like to treat the Satipatthana Sutta as a collection of useful meditation practices, and you could choose one or choose several and follow them. What Venerable Analio does is he goes through all of them, all of the ones that he thinks are the core of the Satipatthana, but he goes through all of them sequentially. So he starts with the body parts. Then he goes to, elements. And then he does the core. So I wasn't sure about the order. And he gets the order right. And then he does the feelings, the Vedanas. So he goes through all of these. But he has a couple of elements in there that are his own introductions or borrowed. I'm not going to go into details, but one of the big ones is that he uses body scanning in all of this. That's not in the Satipatthana Sutta or in any other sutta. So even Venerable Analio has done a few things to create his own practice rather than stick entirely to a hardcore orthodox practice. Another area that I think is worth touching on is metta practice. For one thing, the metta practice that we know and that we've all been taught is also a relatively recent development. This also is from Venerable Analio. If you go back and look at the actual suttas in the Pali Canon, this stuff of where you focus on yourself and then you focus on a benefactor and then a friend and then a neutral person and so on, and you do the four-part chant, this is all later. It doesn't appear in the suttas at all. In fact, in the suttas, the only metta practice, and the Buddha talks about metta and metta practice a lot, but the only place in the suttas where the metta practice appears, he basically says, radiate good wishes or radiate kindness first forward and then to each side and then backward and then up and down. So, and that's all he does. That's all that's in there. And so that's what Venerable Analio does. And it's by itself, I think, a very powerful practice because the idea of radiant friendliness, for me, is actually stronger than the more recent formal metta practice that we've all been taught. But part of this is that for metta is a wonderful practice. When Philip Moffat told me 10, 12 years ago that I should do more metta practice, I was going, ooh. Because for me, the meta practice that I had been exposed to by at that point was very, it really got me into thinking a lot, because you're supposed to repeat these phrases, you visualize somebody, you repeat these phrases, imagining that person and directing those wishes towards that person very specifically, and imagine that person receiving these things. And it was like running home movies. I started thinking about old conversations. You know, it's like I just get completely lost in. So for me to get anywhere in the meta practice, I had to let go of that. And I went to a meta retreat where for 7 days I could just experiment with what worked. And I found that just letting go of the chant, except for just a little bit to keep me honest, and then just focusing on the emotional connection of radiating loving kindness and feeling the piti and the sukha, the joy and the happiness that came up, and feeling that sort of reinforce itself, that worked really, really well for me. But different things work well for different people. Philip has found that having a longer chant really works for him. He's more verbal than I am. Other people find that the visualization is the strongest part of it. So meta practice is a practice where to make it work, it's not going to work for most people if we stick to some kind of orthodoxy. We have to discover and create the practice ourselves. Whereas if we're hardcore, if we stick to an orthodoxy or stick to whatever is in the suttas, we might miss out on this entirely. Some years ago, I heard Sylvia Horstein at a retreat talk about a yogi who, in a group meeting, said, "My family hates me when I'm a Buddhist, but they love me when I'm a Buddha." So when we identify ourselves as Buddhists, we can get into all kinds of traps, obviously. Can be a way of defining ourselves. It can be a way of identifying ourselves. It can get really, really sticky. Am I being a good enough Buddhist here? If I have that ice cream, no, I think, screw it. I'll just have the ice cream. I'll be Buddhist tomorrow. We can also get really passive-aggressive. I've heard a number of people say things in groups like, "My brother-in-law is really a jerk. He really needs meditation practice. It would really help him." And we've probably all had that thought. We probably all know people who could really benefit from the practice. But trying to fix other people, I mean, we've all probably tried it. We've been there. We know how people react to that. It's like back into the ice age. So you really can't fix people. The only thing you can do is you can aspire to be a Buddha. Because the more you become like a Buddha, the more people see your example. And that's the only way you could really have an effect on other people is by an example. Sylvia tells another story of she went to a family gathering many years ago, and it was one of those things where there was a lot of contention, there was a lot of tension and animosity going in the family, outright hostility. And it was something like a wedding, because there were dinner tables and stuff. So she didn't want any part of that, so she went and sat in the corner, and she said what happened was everybody wanted to come and sit with her. Because she was the only one in the room who had any kind of calm, who had any kind of serenity. And if you have that, if you have, and you can't force this, if you have it, and it's genuine, people notice it. And it might take a while, it might take months or even years for your brother-in-law to notice it. But a lot of people do over time. And it can be kind of embarrassing. I was somebody was talking at our meditation group over at the church in Berkeley, and somebody said, "Yeah, I see that that meditation practice really changes people. You're much less of a jerk than you used to be. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of an interesting phrase. Oh, yeah. Bill, yeah. Bill is less of an asshole. I'm deeply proud of that. So you can only aspire to be a Buddha. And the path of practice is becoming, to some extent, a Buddha. Maybe you want to be a monastic and really become like the Buddha and fully enlightened, or maybe you just want to be a little bit more like the Buddha. So a lot of our practice, I think, is finding a middle way. I love coming back to middle way, by the way. A middle way between, on the one hand, following a rigid orthodoxy or any kind of framework that we might get from a teacher or a book. A lot of teachers out there have fairly rigid approaches to what you ought to be doing. And on the other hand, we don't want to be blue laser Buddhists. So I think the path is partly continually finding and rediscovering your own path. I think something like curiosity is a really important tool for that. What's working? What isn't working? What happens when I try this? What happens when I do that? Is there less suffering? Am I less of a jerk? Sometimes you can't tell unless you look over a 5 or 6 year period or longer. But I think there is practice, there is progress, there is practice, and it's continually finding and refinding, rediscovering our own individual path. So once again, I had less talk than I thought I did, so I could throw this up open to discussion, questions, rants.
Since you have
all right,
read a lot more than I have, do you think the Buddha had a sense of humor?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's tricky because I think he did. But, you know, humor is one of those things that's very dated. You look at stuff that was considered funny 50 years ago. A lot of it is just really dreadful. But I think the tattaka thing in some ways is a sense of, it shows a sense of humor, or at least of a sense of paradox. And there are a couple of other places, and I don't remember any offhand. Does somebody remember any of the Buddha stories that show a sense of humor? Not offhand, I guess, is what we'd say right now.
Because to me, there's a lot of delight in humor.
Yes.
But if he wasn't someone to delight, it makes me wonder. You know, meanwhile, there's a lot of great teachers that have a great sense of humor.
The thing about the Buddha, though, is hard to say about his sense of humor, but he was somebody who radiated happiness. And it's hard for me to imagine somebody who radiates happiness who doesn't also have laughter. Maybe it's the whole Santa Claus image, ho, ho, ho. But he was thought of as being the supremely happy one. So yeah, I mean, he sometimes comes across as a sourpuss, but...
The only one I can think of that isn't really humor is the Honeyball, which is talking about the pancha mind. It's a whole sutta talking about how the mind proliferates, you know, all this kind of bullshit when we're creating selves, or, you know, we want something, so we exaggerate how great it is, you know, how the mind just gathers away. They call it the pancha mind. But the name of the sutta is the Honeyball. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of interesting. Why would you call this Yak Ate Mind Sutra a honeyball? And maybe that's some kind of humor that sort of we don't get.
It might also be about the way honeycombs grow with bees adding to them. Well, I thought of one, that the whole metaphor of a dog running around in circles because it's tied to a stake in the middle of somebody's front yard or something. So he might have been conjuring up a humorous image to people. Well, not to me, but people used to laugh at dogs chasing their own tails. Yeah.
So Philip once asked me, he didn't like my answer, why do you practice?
Are you asking me why I practice?
I don't know. Why do you practice?
That's a great question. It'd be a great question for anybody here. And the thing is, I'll have different answers at different times. Through the practice, I've discovered, well, I'm less of an asshole. That's good. I'm a happier person for it. I cause less suffering around me, and I cause less suffering in myself. I doubt that I'm going to become enlightened in this lifetime. I delight too much in this world. Other people, does anybody want to talk about why they practice or how they define their practice?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I started because I wanted to know stuff. When I was 8 years old, my parents bought me a set of encyclopedias, which I read because I want you to know stuff, but I always have. And then, of course, I got to talk to Philip, and I got to sit with Don't Know Mind. I made me sick. Made me sick to my stomach. I mean, I really thought I was going to puke. Don't like that feeling at all. I don't like surprise parties. I don't like that. Don't like that. One of the reasons why I practice is I really realize is there's no way to know. There's no way to know other than just sitting and having the direct experience. And that's the only way I'm going to know anything. That's the only way I'm going to feel even remotely at peace with myself at all, is to sit there and try and see what's really real. And I also like the fact that I don't like being yanked around by crap. You know, and I still am, but I really like having a choice, a response, rather than just being yanked by this and that. And I think that I've gotten a lot more wiggle room in my life because of that. Don't feel like I'm gonna be enlightened either. My kids will say that I'm a better parent, and that's important.
I love that phrase, wiggle room. That's really, we often talk about the space that we can.
Put some new batteries in there.
Oh, no, it's on. I think it was a bad connection. About finding the space between, as some convicts said, finding the space between craving and using, or the space between anger and violence. And this is something that mindfulness and meditation practice gives us. But
yeah, I need the batteries today.
Okay, but the wiggle room is another really nice way of putting that. Arlette?
Thank you, everybody. I appreciate it. Somewhat related, but somewhat. My thoughts are a little scattered, so I hope you'll bear with me, but I have started reading that book that Kevin Griffin referred to, In the Words of the Buddha by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and, you know, and I haven't studied anything about the Buddha before, so I came to this part about, you know, birth and death, and I really don't believe in it. Mm-hmm. I think. I don't know for sure, just like I'm pretty sure I'm an atheist. So the question about the wager and why practice and why be good, my thinking about that is, well, because you'll be happier. But then I thought, well, just greedy. I want to be happy. That's just like wanting to be rich and comfortable and have an easier life. And, you know, isn't that, so that's just kind of questions that arose. And I guess the direction that it takes me is that there is some kind of innate faith, an object that all I can call is faith, that makes me think that, you know, being the best Buddhist-like or Buddha-like person that I can be is somehow good for the planet and humans and other humans and myself too, and that's what drives me, and that's why I do what I do, try to improve my practice, and I guess that's it.
I like that faith. That we have a faith that that this is going somewhere. That our practice is going somewhere. I would just comment that I think the happiness that we're seeking through practice is something deeper, not a superficial happiness, and it is something that affects the people around us, and it does change the world. And some of that we have to accept on faith. Cheyenne? Hold on a second, let's wait for the microphone.
Well, I think for me, there's several aspects of practice, and I'm often quite aware that I have no idea why I'm doing what I'm doing. It just sort of things go by, and I think, you know, every once in a while this may be an exaggeration, but I don't think it is. Every once in a while it dawns on me that, I'm doing this thing that's totally mechanical, but that's interesting. I'd like to know that I'm being mechanical, and that's a useful kind of piece of information, and practice helps me to do it. I don't know actually if how sitting really works and how it helps me to do these, to have this kind of awareness. So I sort of take it on faith that if I sit and try and focus and be present somewhere in the middle of tomorrow or next week or whatever, something will pop into my awareness that wasn't there. Sometimes in retreat, that process is accelerated and that awareness is much better. But I'm not on retreat 90, however, percentage of the time of my life, so. And the other thing is, over the last number of years, I have discovered that actually feeling metta for people and other people and other things and how the suffering of other people in the world and feeling compassion for them makes me feel good. And it's a very personal kind of thing, and I would like to feel good better, more often, and so I'm happy when that happens. I mean, on an emotional level.
So you are noticing changes then,
yeah,
over time.
Yeah.
And the thing that I found about practice is often the reasons you start practicing are not the benefits that actually come to you. You know, you want to fix something, and that thing doesn't ever get fixed, but something else comes up that turns out to be wonderful. Philip Moffat has told a number of times the story of a student that he was talking to, and the guy said, you know, Philip, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to leave the practice. I've been doing this for 2 or 3 years now, and it's not working, and I'm not getting anywhere with it. And Philip said, well, I'm sorry to hear that. By the way, how's the situation going with your, you know? And the guy said, well, you know, things seem to be better at work, and I'm getting along better with, oh. Often, it's not the things we want to fix that get fixed. They may never get fixed. But things happen. Things come up, and if we notice, allow ourselves to notice, we notice that there is something happening that makes this all worthwhile.
I just want to add that there are a lot of religions that can get you there too, but for me, this path works because when I tried religion, it was too much caught up in stuff that was indefensible and seemed silly and embarrassing when I was questioned on it. So the fact that this isn't attached to something that I have to believe in or some ritual that I have to do works for me. And definitely, if I keep practicing, I suffer less and I cause less suffering for others around me.
Yeah, I think it's much easier for most of us to not have to deal with belief systems.
Right.
There are great practices available. The other thing about the Buddha is he taught for 45 years and he really focused on practice rather than belief system. So there's a very big body of Buddhist practice, whereas, say, the Christian practices that are transformative are a little bit harder to find. They're there. There's a lot of very powerful prayer practices that that can be very useful in our broader Buddhist context as well. Ron?
So I think there are a couple of things that I'm aware of in response to the question. One is that to the limited degree that I have studied Buddhism and understand it, it seems the truest of anything that I've encountered. It seems right. It fits with my deepest sense of how things actually are. And I keep discovering new layers and layers and layers of that, so that it is a reinforcing. And that's about all the things that I take seriously about the nature of things that we take seriously, as though we know anything about what's really out there. And through the practice, I can see much more clearly some of my habits that get in the way of seeing things as they actually are. I could give examples, but this probably isn't the place for that. But so that's the conscious thing that I'm aware of. The mysterious part for me is what other people refer to. I think things just work better after I do a retreat. I'm a therapist, I do therapy, and I've commented many times to friends and colleagues that the work that I do after I've done a retreat is just so much better. It's deeper, it gets into things much more directly, I see more clearly, I have more fun. It just works, and I guess that's the mysterious part for me. I could come up with explanations for it, but at its deepest level, it just is an experience that I have over and over again that it works.
Thank you.
I'm trying to formulate an answer. Thanks, Nita, for the question. And for me, the experience is it's almost like I've been hungry and searching for this all my life. And it's just like getting onto some kind of a train or a track or something that's just right. That it just almost like an inner compulsion that's just full of joy. And that it's almost like, oh, I finally found what I wanted. You know, just really, and I just feel happy and joyful doing it.
And back to Barbara here.
Sometimes I don't feel happy. Am I any happier? But then I realize what I have with practice is a lot more space. I have scope. And so suddenly I don't get caught up in your minor identifications as much. And I can see more. I have more room for compassion. And I have more room to feel connected. And that to me is a big thing right now in my life. I'm grateful.
And I think Tina will be the last one.
I'm actually I wanted to give it to Michael, because
oh,
now
okay.
We know it's going to be
I forgot.
You don't want to say anything?
No.
No. Anymore?
I'll say one thing. Thank you. In response to the question, I would just say, why not?
Good answer.
I actually wanted to say, I practiced one thing that Philip said really resonated strongly with me, and it's coming back home to yourself. And so whenever I practice, I feel that I come back to who I am. And that kind of helps through all the nitty-gritty and coming back to it all the time. Is very good.
Heather Sundberg had a really nice phrase last week that she talked about the natural peace and ease of the mind. Mm-hmm. Great place to come home to. Mm-hmm. So let's just do a little bit of letting go of all the mental activity, settling back physically as much as we're able. And opening again to the experience of the body.